Welcome back to part two of the news from the Decatur area. We will be reading articles from the Herald and Review and the Decatur Tribune. This from Springfield. Students get inside the story during legislative tour with Barrickman by Dan Petrella. Students from one Central Illinois state Senate district got a firsthand lesson Wednesday in how difficult it is to advance legislation in the General Assembly. State Senator Jason Barrickman, Republican of Bloomington, invited about 50 students from throughout the 53rd Senate District to the Capitol to participate in his annual Youth Advisory Council. The students proposed a mock bill that would have allowed students to use portfolios in place of standardized test scores when applying for college. However, like many seemingly good legislative proposals, it died in committee. But the goal of the program, which also includes a meeting in the fall, isn't simply to pass legislation. Barrickman said he wants students to see the process up close and to get to know some of the people involved. This is an opportunity for young students to become engaged in the process, obviously learn a bit about how government does and doesn't work, he said. Barrickman said he also wants the students to realize that despite the partisan divisions at the Capitol that there are apparent to the public, there are many good relationships across party lines that help get things done. To illustrate that point, he invited State Representatives Christian Mitchell, Democrat of Chicago, and John Anthony, Republican of Joliet, to speak to the group about their perspectives on criminal justice issues. While they come from different parties, both men are younger black lawmakers with ties to Chicago. They said that helps them find common ground and understand each other's perspectives, even when they don't agree. Annie Shalayan, a senior from Normal West High School who sponsored the mock bill, and took part of the fall session last school year, said the program has gotten her interested in state politics. Senator Barrickman was always really open and candid with us about the issues, what he's doing in Springfield and how to get involved, as well as bringing in people to talk to us who just don't kind of split political rhetoric, she said. Chalian, who plans to attend Indiana University in the fall to study finance and international business, said that the program also showed her that it's easier to have an influence on politics at the state level than in the national level. In fact, Chalian will be interning this summer in Barrickman's office. In addition to participating in the mock committee hearing and listening to guest speakers, including Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice Rita Garman, the students toured the Capitol and met with Governor Bruce Rauner. St. Mary's holding an organ donor drive. St. Mary's Hospital is participating in the National Donate Life Month and will hold an organ, tissue, and bone marrow drive from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Friday. From Decatur, Philip Hoots has a passion for organ donation. As the groundskeeper at HSHS St. Mary's Hospital, Hoots raised the Donate Life flag, which will fly all month at the hospital, including during an organ, tissue, and bone marrow donor drive from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Friday in the main lobby. 2 years ago, Hoot's now 3-year-old son, Crosby, had a rare liver disease called biliary atresia, in which an infant's bile ducts are narrow, blocked, or absent. It was a dire situation, Hoot said. If he didn't get a new liver, he was going to die. Crosby was put on a donor list and at 14 months received a transplant. He decreased from 8 different medicines immediately after the surgery to 1 now, and Hoot said his son is thriving. Since then, I just like to get the word of mouth out and let people know how important it is to donate organs, Hoot said. It can save lives. In the United States, nearly 122,000 men, women, and children are awaiting an organ transplant, and another person is added to the nation's organ transplant list every 10 minutes. In 2003, April was declared National Donate Life Month, a time to encourage Americans to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors. Last year, about 30,000 people began new lives thanks to organ transplants. Gift of Hope Donation Coordinator Susan Hammond said 59% of the Illinois population is registered and 62% of Macon County is, but it needs to be even higher. Hammond said to ignore the myths about who can and can't donate. I hear I'm too young to donate or I'm too old to donate. Those things are not true, Hammond said. We've been doing a good job of getting the word out and getting people registered, but there's a huge shortage. During Friday's event, participants can sign up to donate and learn more about what it means to be a donor. St. Mary's, which partners with Gift of Hope, an organ and tissue donor network, and Be the Match, a bone marrow registry as part of the Hospitals for Hope campaign, has made a goal to register 100 new organ donors by the end of April. I had an acquaintance who was in her 40s who needed bone marrow and died waiting last fall. And 350 people in Illinois die every year waiting for an organ or tissue, says Sister Rita Mary Brown, a health advocate at St. Mary's. The need is so enormous. And now I think I'll pick up some news from the Decatur Tribune. This is the online version. And I'll start out with Paul Osborne, City Beat. Former Decatur police chief is supportive of fired police chief Brad Sweeney. Retired Decatur Police Chief Mark Bartholomew has issued a letter to the editor in support of fired Decatur Police Chief Brad Sweeney. The letter, which is also posted in the Letters to Editor section of this website and will be posted in the print edition of next week's print edition of the Decatur Tribune, states, "I retired from the Decatur Police Department after completing 30 years of service. I rose through the ranks from patrolman to chief of police. As the city's police chief, I worked under a previous city manager. Although the city manager and I had differences of opinion, there were some things I refused to do because I felt it was not in the best interest of the police department. I was never disciplined, never fired, and certainly was never challenged over my integrity or judgment. I worked with Brad Sweeney for the last 10 of my 30 years. He was honest, reliable, and he carefully guarded the image his badge represented in the eyes of the public, as well as the reputation of the department. The city manager had other options to deal with what he has alleged as infractions on Sweeney's part. He could have suspended the chief for 5 days or more. The council indicated it is not their job to become involved with personnel matters and that the authority for such belongs exclusively to the city manager. I disagree. The positions of police and fire chief are very different from other department heads. Brad Sweeney is also a taxpayer. Does he have no right to individual meetings with council members to air his side of the matter? Just give him the courtesy of listening. What background investigation was undertaken before the council hired the city manager? Who conducted that investigation? Based on what I know of the situation, if I were a betting man on where the honesty lies in the current situation, my money would be on the chief. What happens during some city council meetings can never be anticipated by the mayor. Russell Schulke, a regular speaker during a Decatur City Council's appearance of citizens session at each council meeting, offered something new at the last meeting that no one expected and will never forget. Schulke was speaking about the history of the public library when he hesitated and collapsed with an apparent cardiac arrest. Fortunately for Schulke, top city officials were sitting near him and rushed to his side. City Councilwoman Dr. Dana Ray and Fire Chief Jeff Abbott administered CPR and an automated external defibrillator and saved his life. He was transported to the hospital where the last report indicated that he is recovering from the incident. Kudos to Dr. Ray Abbott, City Manager Tim Gleason, Interim Police Chief Jim Getz, and other city officials for reacting so quickly. The most important action taken at that council meeting was the saving of a man's life. It's reasonable to assume that, had Mr. Schulke been somewhere else that Monday night, he could have passed away. Despite the intensity that sometimes comes with subjects debated and voted on at council meetings, it might be the safest place outside of a hospital to have a medical emergency. I am sure when Mr. Schulke returns to address his council, his subject will be appreciation for the action taken to save his life. A similar incident. The incident with Russell Schulke reminds me of a time when I was mayor when a similar situation occurred, although not as serious. Craig Coyle, who was head of the Economic Development Corporation, was making a presentation to council, and after speaking for a few minutes, he paused and looked as if he was going to pass out. I asked him if he was okay, and I remember his two-word reply, "Not really." He backed off a few feet and was able to make it to one of the seats in the front row while others immediately rushed to help him. An ambulance was called and he was transported to the hospital where he checked out okay. He was somewhat embarrassed by what had happened and explained that the day had been filled with meetings and he had been so busy that he hadn't eaten and was lightheaded as a result. Fortunately, it wasn't something major. The fake drop-dead routine. A fake medical emergency happened somewhat routinely during the years I chaired the council meetings when David Dacre would appear before the city council and speak out on drive-through liquor sales. Dacre would ask the question, "How drunk can you be and still buy liquor at a drive-up liquor window?" Then to demonstrate his point, he would fall to the floor and his legs and feet would go up in the air before coming down to show that a person could be dead drunk and still buy liquor at the drive-up liquor window. The first time it happened, it got everybody's attention. After the first time, every time he did that or something similar, everyone just assumed it was the same demonstration and didn't pay much attention to it. I wonder what would have happened if he was really having a medical emergency and those who could help thought it was another dead drunk act. Well, that's not likely to happen. Dacre moved to another state a few years ago, and I haven't heard from him since, but I suspect he attends council meetings in the community where he moved. Changing perception of Decatur is a limitless task. Our front page carries the story that Decatur's crime rates have decreased over the past 20 years and compares them to other metropolitan areas in central Illinois. Nicole Bateman, Community Marketing Manager with the Economic Development Corporation of Decatur in Macon County, did a solid job of revealing those statistics at last Thursday's Community Leaders Breakfast. I'm not sure you can read all of the small print in the statistical chart, which I had to reduce down to make it fit on the front page, but the drop in crime in our community should reassure residents and those looking to come to Decatur that conditions are improving. Of course, a few people are in denial of anything factual that doesn't fit how they feel about crime or any other issue. The bottom line for our community or any community is how safe people feel who live here. The difficult part of any campaign to improve a community's image is not presenting facts that show the community is much safer than it was 20 years ago, but to break an almost inbred feeling that Decatur is not safe. Getting people to feel safe through presenting the facts that should make them feel safer is a long-term process. Even though statistics and facts that show Decatur is a safer place than 20 years ago to educate residents about the quality of life here, most people judge how safe it is by how safe they feel, not by what statistics indicate. However, publicizing the good news about Decatur is a great step forward and hopefully will help shape the image of our community as we move forward. News from here and there. Richland students contribute to facility and curriculum design. A gift of $1.7 million from the estate of Dell and Evelyn Carroll set the stage for a community fundraising campaign and a new and innovative process for the design of facilities on the campus of Richland Community College. The Carroll Center for Enterprise and Innovation will be developed through a process BLDD has proposed called design thinking and involves 5 steps. First, discovery. Review of exemplar facilities with Richland faculty members, students, administration, and community members. 2. Empathy. BLDD will observe Richland class sessions to gain an understanding of how the current environment responds to 21st century educational needs. 3. Ideate. BLDD will develop and refine concepts through a public charrette process, ideally resulting in 2 to 3 preferred concepts. 4. Prototyping. Mock-up spaces designed to facilitate the changes discovered during the previous stages. Observe the functionality and efficiency of these spaces for design concept. And lastly, the college will test the preferred concept prototypes through use of the spaces for a yet-to-be-determined time frame. BLDD will collect information on successes and failures of each prototype and present the summary to the college. Students are participating in the ideate process by providing feedback to BLDD architects and designers about what is currently working well on Richland's campus and what improvements could be made to create an ideal learning environment. The physical construction for the Carroll Center for Enterprise and Innovation will include portions of the second floor of the South Wing as well as a new entry into the space. Simultaneously, Richland will improve and revise curricula to reflect current technology trends and the need of local businesses. The foundation for the improved curricula will be project-based, thus engaging students' mind in working through business-based projects in a collaborative manner, producing scalable outcomes. Most importantly, project-based learning will be applicable to all disciplines at Richland Community College. Larry Foster, chairman of the Richland Community College Foundation Capital Campaign, said, "Our vision is to create a student-centered business education program with advanced technology and collaborative learning spaces that will provide students with a realistic business simulated environment." Early last year, the Richland Community College Foundation launched a community-wide fundraising campaign aimed toward transforming the college's business education center. To date, approximately $3.5 million has been raised in support of this project. Next piece of this, veteran prosecutor joins the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott has announced that veteran prosecutor John Fisher has been hired as an assistant Macon County State's Attorney. He will serve as lead prosecutor of the Gang and Weapons Prosecution Unit and will prosecute homicide and other serious violent crimes. A Decatur native, Fisher is a graduate of Quincy University and St. University University School of Law. He served as an assistant state's attorney in Madison County, Illinois, from 2004 to 2015. During his final 2.5 years there, he held the position of chief of the criminal division, supervising 8 felony assistant state's attorneys, the head of the misdemeanor division, and the attorneys assigned to Veterans Court, Drug Court, and Mental Health Court. He has extensive trial experience, including the prosecution of homicides, violent crimes, drugs, sex, and white-collar offenses. In 2015, for his outstanding work both in and out of the courtroom, John received the Prosecutor Award from the Southwestern Illinois Law Enforcement Commission and the Southern Illinois Police Chiefs Association. In addition, he served on the Madison County Child Advocacy Center's Accreditation Board. Fisher has been an assistant attorney with the firm of Featherston, Gaumer, Postlewaite, Stocks, Flynn, and Hubbard in Decatur since July of 2015. Macon County is extremely fortunate to have someone of John Fisher's caliber as a prosecutor, Scott said. We're very excited to have him joining the office. He has an outstanding trial record and extensive experience prosecuting violent criminals. He's a great addition to the office and will definitely help us keep Macon County safe. Macon County Child Advocacy Center to be renamed Child First Center at Grand Reopening Ceremony. Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott and the Macon County Child Advocacy Center Director Jean Moore have announced that after nearly 17 years of working to protect children in both Macon and Piatt counties, the Macon County Child Advocacy Center is changing its name to more accurately reflect the Child First Doctrine, which all disciplines investigating child abuse in the multidisciplinary team model seek to follow. The Macon County Child Advocacy Center has collaborated with law enforcement, prosecutors, the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, medical providers, and mental health service providers to provide investigation and appropriate treatment services to children and their families since 1999. Over 3,600 children who have been alleged to be victims of sexual or physical abuse have received forensic interviews, education, legal advocacy, case coordination, and referrals for counseling and medical services since the center first opened its door. An open house will be held at the center's new location, 800 East Clay Street in Decatur, on Thursday, April 28, 2016, from 3:30 to 6 o'clock p.m. All are welcome to attend. Members of the multidisciplinary team will be present to recommit their organizations to the important work of child abuse investigation, prosecution, treatment, and prevention. A grand reopening ceremony will be conducted at 4 p.m., at which time the center will be renamed the Child First Center, and the center's new logo will be unveiled. Adopting the name the Child First Center corresponds with a new era in the investigation and prosecution of child abuse cases in Macon County, Scott said. The team effort of the Macon County State's Attorney's Office, law enforcement, and the staff of the Child First Center is currently at an unprecedented level. Assistant State's Attorney Kate Kurtz has aggressively and successfully prosecuted child sex offenders. Since accepting the position as lead prosecutor of all child sex cases in Macon County 18 months ago, she has achieved a 100% jury trial conviction rate and has obtained prison sentences totaling 231 years against sexual predators who prey on innocent children, our most vulnerable victims. Her success would not have been possible without the crucial services offered by the dedicated staff of the Child First Center. The services and resources provided by the Child First Center are absolutely essential to successful prosecutions of child sex offenders, Kurtz added. The center provides a safe and child-friendly environment for a child to provide a detailed description of the sexual or physical abuse he or she endured. This disclosure is often nearly as traumatic for the child as the abuse itself. Without the Child First Center, child victims wouldn't feel comfortable describing the embarrassing details of the offenses committed against them. The first interview is a key component to the ultimate outcome at trial. It can be the difference between a child predator being sent to prison or walking the streets. The staff at the Child First Center work hand in hand with law enforcement and prosecution to advocate for children, stated Decatur Police Chief Jim Getz. They give the victim child a choice, a voice. I want to get to the obituaries before we get too late into the half hour. These are as published in the Herald and Review today. Philip A. Hennington, 56, of Decatur, went to be with the Lord and his mother on Monday, April the 11th, at 2016. Funeral service celebrating Phil's life will be at 10 a.m. Friday, April 15th, 2016, in the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday in the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to the donor's choosing. Casual attire is welcome. From Strasbourg, Claude E. Mose, Jr., 80, of Strasbourg, formerly of Henton, Illinois, died at 6:55 p.m. Tuesday, April 12th, in Shelbyville Manor. He was preceded in death by his parents, son-in-law, brothers, sisters, and a great-grandson. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, April 16th, in Howan Yaki Funeral Home in Shelbyville, Illinois, with Pastor James Ferguson and Pastor Steve Williams officiating. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. Saturday. Burial will be in Gaskill Cemetery near Strasbourg, Illinois. Memorials may be given to the Henton Church of God. Brian E. Schroat, 46, of Decatur, former Goods Furniture Store manager, died Monday, April 11th. Services will be at 10 a.m. Friday in St. Paul's Lutheran Church. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the church. Burial in Macon County Memorial Park in Harristown. And some letters to the editor in the Decatur Tribune. So-called state reforms means eroding principles that built the middle class. Dear editor, more and more Illinoisans are feeling the pain of the impasse between businessman Governor Bruce Rauner and the Democratic legislature. Vendors and local governments aren't getting any monies owed by the state. Colleges and universities are considering layoffs, or at least one school is likely to do, closing its doors. A lot of the media would have you believe that the Democrats are to blame for this mess, even though the legislature passed a budget on time last year and offered to work with Rauner on companion legislation to cut spending and increase taxes. But it refused to consider the governor's ideas for making Illinois more business-friendly. What does that mean exactly, and why are business-friendly reforms such an immovable roadblock to a state budget? At their core, such so-called reforms mean eroding the principles that built the middle class and U.S. prosperity beginning in the 1930s. Suggested measures such as right-to-work zones, an elimination of prevailing wages for local contracts, a tax structures that helped level the field between business and labor, and provided a better standard of living and greater workplace safety for all Americans. Creating the 40-hour work week, with time and a half for overtime, helped workers climb out of poverty, buy homes, and send their children to college. Decent wages fueled a customer-driven national economy and created millions more jobs. Despite the benefits to all, business leaders have been trying to roll back these gains for more than 8 decades. Rauner has had some success, thanks to friendly media, in making Democrats and their leaders the villains in this standoff. If that results in a Republican legislature next year, Illinois' middle class will be big losers as wages stagnate, are cut, and compensation for even the most heinous workplace injuries is limited. And that was written by Bobby Mann from Decatur. This next letter, wind farms hazardous to your health. The recent 5th International Conference on Wind Turbine Noise revealed empirical data supporting the supposition that adverse physiological effects on people occur due to infrasonic emissions at many wind farms. This data was recently published in WindWatch, Wind Energy Documents, in an interview with Malium Swinbank. Infrasonic emissions are generated by the aerodynamic lift forces on the blades, without which power could not be generated because of lack of driving torque to rotate the blades. Infrasound is a product of the difference in the air pressure created by the blade traveling faster at its tip than at its center. This inadvertently creates a nocebo effect, defined in medicine as an inert form of therapy causing harmful effects in patients. Swinbank acknowledges that for years, low frequency and more recently infrasonic noise levels contribute to nausea, dizziness, headaches, uncomfortable chest pressure, and significant sleep disturbances among those living within wind farm borders, minimized with a 6,000 feet setback. All of this begs the question, does the Macon County Board care? And that was written by Bob Kimmons from Warrensburg. This next one says, observations on noise pollution policy in Decatur. Dear editor, I'm confused about a coherent noise pollution policy in Decatur, and I'd like to offer my observations to aid in discovering an equitable context for change. Living within Decatur affords most residents the opportunity of listening to the startling blare of a railroad locomotive horn, which is loud, large, and required to be blown at every intersection day or night. It's most reassuring to know the switch engine that awoke me at 3 o'clock a.m. blows his horn at each crossing for the safety of maybe the lone car, already stopped by the crossing lights and impatiently waiting for the train to pass. Less sarcastically, I'll challenge the city computer wizards to consult a map and discover how many neighborhoods are impacted by the tracks and crossings that define industrial Decatur. If one were to plot the designated honk sites with activity and time of the day, I have reason to believe you'd see the need to reconsider the abrasive requirement inside Decatur. By contrast, the 24/7 railroad horn noise intrusion is currently mandated, and yet the sound of a church bell on Sunday morning, a sound that draws a neighborhood and a community of all faiths together, is banned. I'm having trouble understanding the rationale, and I'm disturbed by the societal implications. Lest I forget, though, thanks for the city stepping up to address the boombox cars. The rental house across the street from me had tenants with car stereos that would vibrate bottles off my window ledges with heart-stopping bass. I don't miss their monster stereos at 3 a.m. a bit, and I wouldn't miss the railroad horns either. I submit that requiring railroad horns at road crossings within our community is an unnecessary and redundant safety requirement. Lights, sound, signs, and automated crossing barriers exist and are already in place. If a driver has difficulty discerning flashing red lights, I would suspect some impairment issues might be at play. So waking an extensive neighborhood and echoing through the even more with incessant diesel horns probably won't make a statistical difference. However, the absence of noise intrusion could vastly improve the quality of life for all our residents who live within earshot of crossings. Then there's the issue of church bells. I can't understand how the greater good is served by their absence. Drawing the faithful, tolling the joys and endings of life, celebrating holidays and marking time are traditional functions of bells that positively unite people and make them feel like part of a community, but are currently being denied to the residents of our city. We deserve better. Banning the appeal of a church bell, yet condoning the gigantomous honking of railroad engines in our backyards, is telling insight into the priorities of whom our elected officials actually serve, I think. I'd like to imagine I'm wrong, but I fear I'm not. Perhaps someone will propose mandatory honking of automobile horns at every road intersection for the safety of all drivers. That requirement would make the railroad horn seem minuscule. Problem solved, eh? And that's by Kim B. Jameson of Decatur. And another sports article. Training for spring. More is fun for Harper. And this was written by Aaron Dow. After a resurgent season for MacArthur softball, a personally successful year where she branched out in a new position, Kia Harper didn't stop. The MacArthur senior decided she needed to do everything she could to be ready for her last season with the Generals, so she decided to push herself a bit more. That meant off-season training with the football team. Tuesdays and Thursdays was with the softball team, and all the other days it was just me and the football boys, which is kind of awkward because I was the only girl up there, Harper said. The results were quickly noticeable. After putting herself through strenuous workouts week after week, Harper saw a difference. I got into really good shape. It was hard, but it was really good, she said, and it was fun, too. That's the key word for Harper when it comes to softball, fun. She's tried other sports, but none connected quite like softball. Much of that comes from her dad, Richard. My dad was actually a really good baseball player in high school, so I actually started when I was 2, watching him play slow-pitch softball, Harper said. I just fell in love with the game. After spending 3 days a week watching at an early age, she picked up the sport herself at 4. Then came travel ball at 8, and she made varsity as a freshman with MacArthur. The softball field has been an oasis for the senior. She admits there were days where the enthusiasm subsided before practice and games, but something clicks when she steps onto the diamond. Nothing else matters when I'm on the field, she said. That happiness took a hit that freshman season. The Generals managed only a few wins, and she didn't see eye to eye with the teammates. And that's all I have time for today. This is Kathy signing off with the news from Decatur, from the Herald and Review, and from the Decatur Tribune. You have a good evening. Thanks.